Welcome to Season 2 of Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. I'm going to tell listeners that we have engineering today, Tom Grady. Steve Corey is off doing other things. We're delighted to have him at the helm. And we also have two guests who will tell you a lot about food sovereignty from a new angle to this community. But before we do that, I'm just going to say a few words about the fact that we're now facing circumstances in this province that are really germane to the need for food sovereignty. The transport system in this province has been shut down since a week ago on Wednesday, and we have now learned that there are more atmospheric rivers coming to wreak a little more havoc, and the preparations for those are going to be very, very hard to engineer. As a result, food distribution into this community from the sources which it has often come from, which are very far away, is utterly interrupted. And all sorts of emergency measures to bring food into the Shuswap have been having to put in place. As a result, we can see clearly when we see the empty shelves within days of the initial events, the weather events, we can see why a system that sends food 5 to 10,000 kilometers around the globe is eminently fragile, and its ability to adapt to the changing climate and extreme weather events that we're all going to be facing in the next few years is really very inadequate. So we're going to be talking about things that can be done to make that situation better, and my two guests are very well situated to do that. First of all, back again after last week, we have Kelly Westgate, owner and certified permaculture designer with Lekker Land Design. And for those of you who weren't listening last week, Lekker means tasty in every sense of the word, and it's a Dutch word that Kelly picked up when she was on an exchange in the Netherlands. And her business does land design, educating around composting and design system, food systems, and puts them in place. We also are pleased to have Joel Torrens with us today. Joel is the pastor and executive director for the Salvation Army here in Salmon Arm, where he oversees such things as the food bank, the homeless shelter, and church services. Welcome, Kelly and Joel.
Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
It's lovely to have you here on the show and to have you both helping establish new ways of creating food sources in our community, which is what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about a venture which, in two words, is called a food forest. The concept of food in the forest is not new. Our indigenous friends and neighbors have known about that for thousands and thousands of years, but we folks who landed from other parts of the world are only beginning to recapture some of those approaches that were really effective for those many thousands of years. Starting off, just to recap in one or two sentences, Kelly, your entire life story from our last program. last week, Kelly was once a little girl who incessantly read books in a ponderosa pine tree off the porch of her home. And over the years has become passionate about nature, about trees, about wild animals, and about social justice, and has a certificate in liberal studies from UBC, if I understand, 2012, and then earned a certificate in permaculture design, and you'll hear more about permaculture as we go on with the program, and the elements of eco-design in 2014. Kelly is the expert on food and setting up food systems that will tell you a lot about what we're going to do with the food forest. Joel, we're going to share some of your life story with our audience, because everyone that has been interviewed on this show has a trajectory that brings them not just to this community, but to the place where they are in their life right now. In your case, of course, it was foreordained. Your parents were both in the Salvation Army. Your wife's parents...
Sorry, my parents were not. They were missionaries, but not in the Salvation Army.
Well, they were the next best thing to being in the Salvation Army then. And your wife's parents were in the Salvation Army.
Yes.
So you could see that you either had to marry for love or you had to marry for membership in the Salvation Army. At any rate, joking aside, clearly that was a big part of your life early on. And in fact, you and your wife met at school when you were both at Tyndale College, I recall.
Yeah, Tyndale University College. Her family has generations of Salvation Army officers. My family had generations that had met their spouses at that particular school. so we were both doomed to repeat history.
So it was... you told me it had a nickname, this school. What's the nickname of this college?
It used to go by the name Ontario Bible College, and it was affectionately called Ontario Bridal College, the school where you went to get your MRS.
Oh, dear. Well, if you have to go somewhere, it's probably better than going to some sleazy bar, let me tell you. You probably had a lot more enlightening conversations. Now, you also had a bit of a connection with Salmon Arm before you got here. You did your training and your education and your induction into the Salvation Army. But you also came here before you actually officially came here on an established basis. What was that like?
I connected with the officer who had been here previously. Martin Ketteringham and Carolyn Dunan were our predecessors, and Martin and I were part of an emergency response in 2017. And we were largely located in Abbotsford at that time, but we were at the Provincial Command Center aware of what was happening throughout the province with fires and tracking where emergency response vehicles were. And that's when I began to hear stories about Salmon Arm, about the community, about the people, and got to see some pictures and start to feel more connected to the community.
Our propaganda started to influence you. Good.
It worked.
We're very glad. And so you came here. This was your first posting in, do you call it in the field when you're in the Salvation Army? Do you call it my first posting in the field or something like that?
Yeah, that language works.
Well, we're very glad you're here, and we're glad that you heard those rumblings. What was the kind of gist of what you were hearing about this community before you actually formally arrived here?
Well, I mean, the first thing that everyone told me was how great the pie was. Everyone always
told me
that. The
Pie Company.
Absolutely, but I also heard about just how when you're driving on the highway and you come around the bend and you see the lake unfold before you and the city at the end of it, just how incredible that was. And then you begin to hear the stories about the people and the warmth and the kindness and the generosity. It's a very special place. And it was, I think, just before I arrived here that Salmon Arm was crowned the best place in Canada.
Well, we paid a lot of money for that. No, I'm sorry. We didn't pay a lot of money for that. That was something we got gratuitously, and we're very pleased that that happened. I recall myself coming in 1979 over the same hill and seeing McGuire Lake open up with the fountain. And I didn't know the hospital was right next door to it where I would be working. But I thought, well, that'd be a nice place to hang out. And lo and behold, that's where I ended up. It's a town that has kind of wended its way into your heart because you were saying you'd kind of like to have a good stretch here. In other words, you'd like to spend... one of the ways the Salvation Army works, as you explained to me, was that every few years you get transferred to another location. And you kind of have to use the grapevine to spread the word that you'd kind of like to hang around in one particular place. Is that kind of informal... method, one of the methods that people in the Salvation Army use?
Yeah, I mean, there is a similarity in the Salvation Army to how the Canadian Armed Forces work in that we are appointed to different communities in Canada. And you asked me last time we spoke if there's a regular interval at which people are moved. And in the past, there has been, but there's a little bit more consultation now. There's a little bit more working together on figuring out the best way to support the communities in this country. And we've made it known we want to be here for a while. We don't want to be packing our bags. This is a great place to live. This is a great place to raise our daughter. And there's so much potential to do great things in this community, partnering with this community.
Yeah, many organizations, the hospital often shifts people around from one ward to another. So the argument is you don't want to get stale. But if you establish a good relationship with people in a community, then there's great delight in building on those relationships. And we talk about relocalizing all sorts of things, including the food system. And maybe that's something we should apply to human relationships as well. Anyway, you can pass that on to the hierarchy of the Salvation Army. We'll see if they pay any attention. Anyway, we're certainly delighted to have you here. Now, many people think of the Salvation Army and they think of music. They think of the band. And I'm only going to just touch on that because later on we talk about music with respect to the food garden, and I'm going to ask you to expand on music when we talk about that, because it's a wonderful concept. You saw, Joel, in Seattle, you saw a food garden, a food forest rather, and it caught your attention.
Yeah, it was, I was with a friend of mine from Germany, and she was asking, do people just pick food off of trees here in the way that they do in my home? And I'd never heard of this before. I was like, I don't know about that. That's not something I've really heard of. We don't have a lot of public fruit trees.
Yes, you said that if people pick food off trees, they get arrested for stealing apples or something like that.
Yeah, it's just not... it's not what's done. You know, if you're picking fruit, it's probably off of somebody's private property. And that was just the beginning. It planted a seed. Sorry for the pun. it planted that first seed of, okay, here's an interesting idea of something that's happening in the world that I've never encountered before. And that seed just kind of sat there,
yes,
unnoticed, unattended, for
ready to germinate, but in the right circumstance. Sorry, yeah. We're going to have a theme of germination seeds all the way through this program if we're not careful. What really got things started as far as the food forest, you know, itself was when Jenny Carter, who is the pastor, the minister at First Community / Green Space, the United Church, all of which are sort of a collocation of various kinds of functions. She called a meeting. And when was that and what happened?
Oh, I think that was in May or June of 2020. And the pandemic was still in those very early stages. And people were beginning to ask about systems and structures. And if this goes longer than we think it will, how are we going to promote food security? How are we going to make sure that our supply chain isn't disrupted? And it was a meeting I was invited into because we operate the registered food bank in Salmon Arm. And I went in from that perspective of we are contributing positively in this field. We have a food bank. We are doing the thing. And just hearing the way that others talked about food security. I remember specifically, there were a number of people on that call, but I remember specifically Serena Kaner from the Food Action Society. Hearing the way that she spoke about food security, I was really challenged in my preconceived notions and began to think food security is a lot more than just food provision. It's about that connection to where our food comes from. It's about knowing what to do with that. It's about education. It's about advancing people in food careers.
Now, Joel, in addition to running the food bank, you also were picking up food on a regular basis from food sources, retailers in town on a regular basis. Why don't you tell us about those sources of food? They're not addressing the food security problem necessarily, but they were sources for people in Salmon Arm that you made available.
Yeah, so it's a part of the system, and it's something that we're very thankful to be able to do. Every day we go out to our grocery partners, to some of our restaurant partners, and we pick up anything that is no longer saleable according to their standards. And it's a great way to prevent food waste because we're able to pick up produce and grocery and bakery items. We go to Askew's uptown and downtown. We go to Walmart. We go to Save-On. We get regular contributions from No Frills. It's a great way of just continuing that cycle of food and keeping food out of the landfills.
Yes, reducing food waste. I believe it's 40% of food in Canada is wasted, which is a terribly discouraging figure to know about. So you had the conversation with Serena, and then you, in addition, as is not unusual when the Schuhart Food Action Society is involved, conversations with Melanie. I think, Kelly, you had a conversation with Melanie about composting, and that started to expand. What was that like?
Yeah, absolutely. Pardon me. We were discussing the possibility of a compost course for homeowners and people that wanted to keep some of that organic material at home instead of sending it to spotless compost. And throughout that process, as we started to get to know each other, you know, she started to make that connection of, wait a second, I know this guy, Joel, and he's at the Salvation Army, and maybe there's something that we can do here. And so she introduced us back in May, April or May, and it was right around the same time that I was starting this new business.
This was April or May of this year?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So this idea, speaking of germination, Joel, this idea had a whole year to germinate.
Yeah, I mean, it started with, can we do public fruit trees? Hmm. And I did some more research and I understood the culture in Germany and where that came from. I saw that Lethbridge, Alberta was planting fruit trees. And I just began to talk to people and say, hey, do you think it would make sense if we put a garden on the property at the food bank? And would that interfere with other things happening in town? Do you think this makes sense to move forward? And so then we got some good feedback and the winter hit and things slowed down. And as soon as things started warming up, we started to have really good conversations with Melanie at the Food Action Society. And she said, hey, you know, we have this permaculturist that we've been talking to, wondering if she can do some consultations for us, if she can do some courses for us. And she would be the person to talk to about this. At the time, we were calling it a garden. The language of food forest really came from Kelly once we started talking about what we could do with our property.
And so, Kelly, you and Joel started to have a conversation, an extended conversation. And how did that evolve? It obviously evolved over time into a more concrete plan, which is now the plan for the food forest. What were the, as you recall, you looking back in your mind, how did that happen? How did you go from picking fruit off trees to a food forest in the complete sense with permaculture attributes to it?
Well, I think as I've learned, as you mentioned earlier, Warren, about the, you know, indigenous culture and whatnot, and having moved out from the coast to the interior specifically for food security after experiencing a landslide, conveniently, you know, interestingly for the timing, but yes. You know, there was a landslide into the aquifer in Vancouver when I lived there and was pregnant, and the water was murky and you had to go buy water for, you know, brushing your teeth and for every little thing. And it really sunk in how quickly the situation can change and how quickly people tend to start hoarding, you know, foods and water and how vulnerable really we are. And sure. So that really made a deep impression on me, I think particularly because I was pregnant at the time. And, you know, you have that mama bear internal, you know, I need to protect the baby. And so...
You're part of the demographic that is most concerned about environmental degradation, women with young children. It's something intensely motivating. And I'm sure, Joel, when you think about your daughter, you think about her future as well. Yeah. So you start to have these conversations, and then it was a little smoky, so you couldn't necessarily do things outdoors. But you started to plan. And how did the plan evolve?
Well, we did a visit with some of the interested stakeholders. So we walked the property, and if you've been to the area, you'll know that it's basically grass. There's no irrigation or anything. So for me as a designer, it's a wonderful blank palette to start from. And we discussed, you know, the entire property and future ideas of connecting to adjacent lands. And we decided that, you know, developing the front area would be ideal, and that we wanted, you know, there is such a high volume of traffic around the building as well. And so we wanted to create something that had a flow to it, that wasn't necessarily like your sort of traditional community garden with raised boxes, which there's nothing wrong with. That's great. But in this sense, you know, the food forestry model and working with permaculture principles gets you into thinking long-term and perennial and improvements over time. And so with the food forest, we're integrating annuals and perennials and pollinator plants. And, you know, it's more of an ecosystem creation, so that what happens there is that it becomes a pleasant place to be, as well as a place where you get nourished, as well as the opportunity to educate people on where their food comes and what it looks like when it's growing and how to know when it's ready to pick.
And education is a key component of this project. It's not just something that sits passively. You want people to interact with it and connect to it.
Yeah, when we have people coming into the food bank, there are certain items that are less popular, and it's often because people don't know how to prepare that particular thing, or they don't have the right kitchen tools to prepare a certain variety of squash that just sits with us until we connect with a local farmer who can feed it to their animals. And so we want to see people recognize these things as they come out of the ground, and we want them to say, oh, that could be a fantastic part of a stew. That could be a great addition or base, or, you know, there's just that whole thing. And I have to confess, I should have said this earlier, Warren, I know nothing about this world. I am standing on the shoulders of giants here. The people that actually know what they're talking about, like Kelly, like Melanie at the Food Action Society, any word that sounds like it belongs in this particular world of gardening, I have learned in the last 6 months from the people that are helping us with this project.
So in light of your declaration of ignorance, I'm going to say, Kelly, you found Joel extremely receptive to the ideas you are bringing to him. Whatever he might have lacked in prior experience, he really adapted well to what you were presenting.
Yes, it's. I think we've all got a bit of a frog in our throat this morning.
There are frogs about a foot.
Yes, it has been so great to work with Joel so far, because he's been very open-minded and very receptive, and just open to the idea that this is going to look a little different than conventional gardening. And it, you know, there's going to be a process of having conversations with the community, and there already has been in the initial installation process. You know, it's really been a beacon of you know, interest for people. They want to know what's going on and what are you doing and why does it look like that, and, you know, so there's that opportunity to engage in conversation with people.
And one of your tools in that conversation was the creation of a spreadsheet. And Joel, when you told me I like spreadsheets in our conversation before the show, I thought, that's not the image of a typical Salvation Army pastor, somebody who likes spreadsheets and is really good at learning new projects to do with food on the front lawn. So you saw the spreadsheet, Joel, and you talked it over with Kelly. And what did you see there that really kind of captured your attention? What made it look like it was something special?
I think the biggest thing was the list of plants that Callie had put together, and just seeing the variety, the breadth. There's so many things that she thinks can fit into this space. And I'm looking at it right now. Radish, potatoes, broccoli, apricots, strawberries, squash, artichokes, Saskatoon berries. There's so much that can be done. And, you know, the spreadsheet is the very, it's very much within the box. And you see that translated to things like her design for the property, the sketch. And it just, it progresses you from, I don't know what's happening. Okay, now I have some information. Okay, now I see the vision. And now that we actually have the hugel beds going in, we see it coming to life. And it's just this amazing creation process.
And you used the term musicality when we were talking about it before. Musicality. Just help our listeners understand how music and a garden do have something in common, this kind of garden in particular, this kind of forest.
I think one of the biggest ways is that there's a lot of complexity, but it's not it's not disconnected. The complexity is all building on top of the different layers that are there, and it comes together to present this seemingly unified piece of art. And it's not until you really sit with it that you see the rhythms that are overlapping, the different elements that are coming together. One of the things in this list, I'm going to go back to the spreadsheet. I'm sorry, I love spreadsheets. But the pollinators, the plants that are there for the pollinators that I never would have thought to include. And it's like that subtle bass line that it's there, it's driving the song forward. And it's not something that you necessarily would hum if you were recalling what the song sounds like, but it's so important to the whole picture. And so the calendula, the nasturtium, all those things that add to the final product and the beauty that's presented.
You know, Joel, you're going to give Salvation Army pastors a whole new image in this community. That was very poetic. That was.
I know, I'm almost crying over
that
here.
That was beautiful. It's a wonderful notion to incorporate a sense of beauty and just attractiveness at multiple levels into what is essentially a project to give people their daily bread in the form of apricots and artichokes. But the idea that somehow we can, somebody once said, truth is beauty. I think it was John Keats said, truth is beauty. Beauty is truth. That is all you need to know. And I think you've just said that in another way, in a very eloquent way. Let's stop for a moment and just, Kelly, could you give us a couple of definitions, just so we kind of, so the listeners are kind of clear. First of all, let's talk about this background issue of permaculture. What is permaculture?
It's always one of the favorite questions that a permie, we call ourselves permies, get asked, because everybody's got a slightly different definition. But essentially, you know, it's a holistic design system that integrates all sorts of what you might think of as exterior parts. So, you know, there are principles behind permaculture, and those, I'll just let you know what they are, because it really does define the lens that I'm looking at things sure. through. So we're to creatively use and respond to change. Very, very significant in this current situation. You know, we've got a design going there that is constantly changing because of our current situation, because of availability of resources and supplies. So there's, you know, we're being very adaptive in this design process as well. We observe and interact. Now, in this particular case, we didn't have a lot of time to observe, but at the same time, there wasn't, you know, the biodiversity on the property was two. I think there's grass and some critters.
And hardy native perennials, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes called weeds by the uninformed.
Yes, exactly. Dynamic accumulators is what we call them in the
dynamic accumulators. That's really going to give weeds a new profile in the community.
It makes them feel special when you call them that.
Indeed.
So we catch and store energy. So that would be things like, you know, down the road, maybe the Salvation Army wants to look at solar panels for energy, but we're looking at rainwater harvesting. You know, with the climate changing, what happens is that we get not necessarily less rain or more rain, but we get it, as we're finding now, in bursts. So very strong. So we need to learn how to collect that when it's there and store it for a later time. Obtaining a yield is another one of the principles. Obviously, we're going to be obtaining a big yield on this one. Self-regulating and accepting feedback. So we find that, well, okay, what we thought was going to happen may not be what is happening, and that's okay. We're not trying to work against nature. We're trying to work with it. So in this sense, we're, as Joel said, inviting pollinators and other species to the property because they're going to help us and support us.
If you build it, they will come. I seem to recall that phrase.
Yes, yes. So we also want to try to use and value renewables. So this is where, you know, we're trying to upcycle wherever possible, which is also great, you know, being that this is a nonprofit project, anywhere that we can try to, as Joel said, keep things out of the landfill or find another life for something that has been used in the past, we're gonna value that. Produce no waste. We've got an integrated compost system that'll be at the center of the property. And this is important because soil is at the heart of it all. If you don't have good soil, you don't have food growing. So we wanted that to be a central to the space. So that, and that's an education process as well, is how to build soil. We're designing from pattern to detail. And this is what Joel said, you know, you start to see the design, you just, you know, it just looks like circles and squares on a piece of graph paper. But once you start to identify what those are and you start to imagine, okay, I know what an apple tree looks like. I know what, you know, strawberries look like. And then once you start to see, okay, I can imagine that area looks like this, it does start to come together in your mind, which brings up the next principle of integration. And so it's not segregating different plants. So in conventional agriculture, we do tend to pick a crop and plant a whole field of the same thing. Whereas in a food forest system, it is that correlation and that relationship between the plants that support each other. One is giving back to the soil. One is giving to the pollinators. One is giving to us. You know, maybe there's the leaves on the tree are creating a mulch for us and that's free. So integrating all of those. Using small, slow solutions, you know, in a project like this with a lot of different stakeholders, people have different speeds that they work at. And I think it is easier and quicker to throw some boxes up and start planting annuals. But in this case, this is something that will get better over time. So the first year, it may look a little bit sparse. But in year two and year three, it's going to get better and better and require less and less maintenance as the system, you know, grows and fills out. And a couple last things we use in value diversity. Again, the more diversity we have in our plantings, the more resilience is baked into the system. So if we have, what we have is 33 different types of food initially, and within that we've got subspecies. So if we've got beans, for example, we may have 5 different types of beans and 4 different types of lettuce. Then if one crop fails, at least you've got a number of others that could be okay. You know, something that we found in Vernon this year was that apricot trees, they're very robust. And while we watched, you know, currants dry up on the bush, or, you know, raspberries, blueberries had a very difficult year, apricots thrived. So, you know, paying attention to those things, and within the, you know, food systems community, these are the conversations we have all the time, there are no guarantees, you know, in gardening or food forestry. You hope and you plan for the best, but, you know, conditions change, and obviously they can change very, very quickly.
It's interesting because when you bring up that whole, many of the principles you've described are principles that have evolved over thousands of years among our indigenous friends and neighbors and their societies. This notion that the forest is beautiful, it has wonderful qualities, but it's also Mother Nature has put together these relationships between plants, and it's our task to figure out what Mother Nature is doing, and then obviously some of it we can use to our own advantage. But ultimately there's this, the harmony is embedded in the system, not something that we've created. It's there for us to nurture and follow and at times exploit some of its wealth. But this, we'll talk a little bit more about indigenous patterns, because I know you're reading about that right now, Kelly. And there is kind of a spiritual aspect to this whole project, non-denominational in the utmost sense. It's sort of deeper than any tradition, but it's something that's really part of the processes of life itself. Now, talking about enriching soil, you said soil is critical for this project. Let's talk about a German concept. It is Hügelkultur.
Yes.
Hügelkultur means something very specific. The literal meaning is it's hill culture, meaning growing in hills. But it's a very specific concept with respect to permaculture and to this particular project as well. Tell us a little bit about Hügelkultur.
Yes. Well, you know, on this site, we have some challenging soil there's a history to each chunk of land. And with this, we know that we were dealing with a very compacted and clay soil, and we need to build soil quickly so that we can grow food in it. So this method is sort of radical soil building, and it's layering in different types of organic material that will sort of juice up over the winter. I guess it's gonna become this lovely rich black soil that we can plant into. So essentially the process is you dig a trench, you line it with cardboard. The cardboard is going to block out any of the surrounding grass that was already there and prevent weeds from coming up. So this is our, you know, using renewables and producing no waste.
This is your massive input of pest control. Cardboard.
Yes. Well, interestingly, the process that we used to install these became such a great way to connect with the community as well. So we built soil, but all sorts of different organizations came to the party to make donations of manure and compost and carbon sources like wood. And I would love the opportunity, maybe Joel can share with you some of the people that did help out in this process. But, you know, we layer all of these bits and mulch them and water them in. And then what happens is over time, that soil gets better and better instead of getting depleted. And you've got the wood buried in there, and that's holding the water, and that's becoming more and more important as we want to be able to hold water in the soil. That's the best place to hold water. So the idea is that the maintenance shouldn't be as intense as other gardens.
So Joel, you're hearing Kelly speak now, but you've also been hearing her display some of this information to you, as you said, learning things that you knew nothing about, but on the other hand, had obviously a real aptitude to learn. What was it like, and what is it like now, as you hear this kind of vision unfolding that Kelly's laying out so eloquently? What's that experience like for you, a Salvation Army pastor who's becoming the master of a terrain which will be growing food for the community?
Oh, master of terrain. Wow. Thank you for making this so much more intimidating than it ever has been. No, it's exciting. And part of it is that as these ideas have kind of been sitting with us, they've been gaining some momentum. And the more I talk to Kelly, and the more we dig into the ground and layer these things, and one of the things Kelly was saying is that it's been a great process of connecting with the community, even just people walking by and asking, "What's this about?" Seeing other people get excited about this idea makes it so much more real than it was 12 months ago. And seeing other people get excited about this idea is just that confirmation. Seeing other people in the Salvation Army that I talk to get excited about this idea. I know we have a public image, but there are a lot of people. I'm not a lone wolf here. There are a lot of people who are excited and doing different things and moving forward, and they share the excitement that I have for this project.
Would it be fair to say, Joel, that this, in the context of the Salvation Army, is kind of moving the organization forward into new kinds of relationships with communities?
Sorry.
I don't think this project is doing that, but I think that this project is one of a number of things happening across the country right now. There's a real appetite within the Salvation Army that's being expressed in our vision statement, our mission statement, and some of the tangible things that are being rolled out. We want to build communities. We want to connect with who's in our communities. One of the goals for the Salvation Army is to be an innovative partner, to be a transforming influence in our communities. And so I'm just a part of a wave.
You sound like you're going to be joining. You are creating. You don't have to join it. You create a new environmental advocacy organization known as the Salvation Army. I mean,
hey,
because
I want to real quick. I just want to come back to something Kelly said earlier.
Yes.
Since you brought that up, Warren, I have to say, if you want to put solar panels on the Salvation Army, give me a call. My daughter would love that. I would love that. And it'd be a great new thing to do.
I'm going to start dialing right away as soon as the show's over.
All right.
Marvelous. Kelly, let's talk about some specifics. Kelly, let's talk a little bit about some of the specifics related to the garden. You've talked about already and in our conversation before the show about annuals, about perennials, about this notion of continuous planting and harvesting, this kind of flow process that's going on. You use the words like beauty, integration. There's one word that I think would kind of sums up a lot of what we've been talking about, and that's the notion of stacked functions. In other words, well, you describe stacked functions and what it means and how it's part of the food forest.
Yeah, so the idea is that each plant that we're planting has more than one purpose and gives us something back. So, you know, for example, Joel mentioned the nasturtium flower. It's sort of your atypical permaculture flower that is indicated in most designs. And the reason for that is because it gives the pollinators something, but at the same time, it's an edible flower. So, you know, you can pick those leaves and eat them. They're quite spicy, but it invites you to try new things, and it's beautiful as well. So, you know, there's a stacked function. The other one would be something like a comfrey plant, not necessarily something that you would eat, but it's something that will plant as a support species with the trees, because that's a plant with a very long tap root. It's bringing up nutrients from deep within the soil, and it will produce a flower if you let it get that far, or you can chop it, use it in the compost, use it as a mulch under the tree. So it's providing a little bit of shade and cooling. And then also the nutrients that it's brought up is building soil.
And comfrey has a medicinal function as well. It's widely Absolutely. Used in herbal medicine.
I used it on a broken bone earlier this year in a poultice, yes.
And it healed overnight.
Oh, yes.
Of course. That's right. Comfrey, once again, coming through.
When you know, you know. Yeah, yeah. I would like to say, you know, part of permaculture, too, is about building community. And I think that's really something that's happening here
you know, and when you attach the Salvation Army name to this type of thing, it's very recognizable and people know. So when we went out to the community to ask for donations of, you know, organic material, essentially, we had quite the outpouring. We had Spa Hills Compost, we had Blends Farm, Blackburn Excavation came out to dig our trenches. We had Mountainside Earthworks and Salmon Arm Ready Mix and Passive Remediation Systems dropped off some soil with some biochar in it. Biochar, very interesting as well. That's a carbon sequestration tool. So, you know, when you're talking about stacking functions, it's like, well, we are building soil, but we're also sequestering carbon and we're also creating you know, homes for microorganisms in the soil that are going to work for us. So even though we're not, it's not lazy, but we do want to create less work over time. And that's the idea with this.
The interesting thing is you're also stacking functions of the citizens of this community. I mean, somebody who's digging, doing excavation of for home building as a major operation comes and does some trenching for you. Somebody who is supplying soil usually for commercial purposes is bringing soil amendments and that kind of thing that can be used for the community. It's interesting how much of a web of interconnections a project like this creates. You mentioned
and we do it intentionally, you know. Yes. With a quote unquote normal installation, we would buy all the parts and we would install them with paid contractors. And this is a very intentional process of, you know, it's complicated in the beginning because there is so much organization, but we want the community to be involved. So that's in the design process. We were allowing for the unknown to come forward. So we didn't know when we started, you know, that Askews, for example, we would get cardboard for the hugel beds. So thank you, Askews, for that. You know, there will be other organizations that get involved. We've already had the Girl Guides out. They helped us plant flower bulbs for the spring. And there's other organizations that'll be involved later on for different parts of the process. And so, like I said, while that complicates it, it's also, there's so much education within it, and it allows people to bring their ideas to the table and their own creativity and their own connections. And it's been very inspiring for a lot of these contractors that have shown up. They don't get the opportunity quite often to work on these kind of, you know, unique and creative projects. And they've all been very sort of fascinated and inspired, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Joel.
We're building a complex and healthy root system. What you're going to see above the ground is a garden where people can come and just grab something to eat. But for it to be really healthy, for it to really succeed, we need those deep, rich roots that spread out and bring the community together.
And the roots are spreading also, as you just described, both you and Kelly have described, roots into the community. There's this interwoven pattern within the community. We're starting to talk about the broader picture now, and I think it's appropriate because this garden is more than just a bunch of plants in the ground and earthworms. It's also symbolic of a kind of relationship we have with the earth. And Kelly, you've been reading lately and immersing yourself in some of the notions from the Shkwepmek people. Maybe you could talk about it a little bit, because food forests have been part of indigenous culture literally for thousands of years in the southeastern states. And in the Amazon basin, they have been shown to be a primary food source. On 1 acre of food forest, you can produce more caloric nutritional value and micronutrients than you can on any of the grain crops that we grow and rely on so much for our food sources. And they're very complete. The food source from a food forest is very complete. So what have you been learning about Shkwepmek ways?
Yes, I picked up this wonderful book, Shkwepmek People, Land and Laws by Marianne and Ronald Ignace. And it's a fascinating collection of the history of this land and people. And it shows that when, you know, settlers arrived to the area, we didn't recognize that there was quote unquote farming happening. It didn't look like what we expected. It looked like nature.
It wasn't neat and tidy and rose.
Untended, right? It was a little more wild, but that's not to say that it was not manufactured or not being, you know, supported by the people. And the idea that, you know, our interaction with the land matters. You know, Indigenous women would dig up the Indian potato and then make sure that they put back into the land. They didn't harvest everything. It was always sort of the law of thirds, right? You know, we harvest some for ourselves, we leave some for nature, and we keep some to plant for next year. And so that's baked into the culture. And this longevity and sustainability and respect for the land, I think it's a very different outlook over things in terms of, you know, not having dominion over the land, but being stewards of the land. That's a different mentality, I think.
Listeners might be interested to know that George Dawson, who the Dawson Creek and Dawson City are named after, came through this area. He came to Shuswap Lake, and he looked at the mouth of the Shuswap River, the Salmon River and the Shuswap River, and he declared it an unhelpful territory. He said the river is too small to navigate up, and there's not much in the way of useful vegetation, and maybe you might plant a few potatoes in the delta, and that's about it. So he moved on. At that same time, Indigenous people here were harvesting every year vast resources of food from the food forest that they had already exploited and knew and understood. Joel, some of the concepts involved in the food garden are also embedded in a kind of progressive sort of Judeo-Christian perspective as well. It's kind of a coming together from that perspective as well. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, at the base of it, there's the Shema in the Hebrew scriptures, but it comes up again in the New Testament. So it's baked into the core of what we believe. What are the greatest things to observe? Well, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. That coming together of communities. And this is such a concrete way to do that. The way that our society has moved and changed and evolved, so often we end up in boxes. We live in our indoor box and travel in our indoor box to another indoor box where we get all our food in boxes. And this is just an opportunity for us all to come out of our boxes, to come together, to interact with the land, to interact with our neighbors, to join together in something beautiful. I think it's part of who we are as humans and people who believe.
That's a great segue, Joel, coming out of our boxes, because before we finish today, I want to invite volunteers in the spring. We've got lots of work to do on the installation in the spring. We'll be building a compost system. We'll be installing some rainwater harvesting. We'll be planting trees and seeds and seedlings and raised beds. So we need people to get involved, and they can certainly reach out through either my website, Lekker Land Design, or through the Salvation Army. If you've got a truck, if you've got a shovel, if you've got some strength, we definitely could use some able bodies.
Strong back and weak mind, we'll welcome them all. I cannot help but see this project as kind of an exemplar of where we need to go. We need to make the whole ecosystem around us strong and vibrant and diverse and interconnected. It's really a project that has implications far beyond its for the immediate practical purpose, and that is to demonstrate to the community at large that there are things we can do that will make things like atmospheric rivers and droughts and even, you know, climate heating beyond acceptability something that not only we but the world that we live in and depend on, the ecosystem, can be secure in. We just have a couple of minutes. Joel, do you have a summation you would lay out for us about this project and what it means to you in a minute?
I'm really excited to know that one day someone will be walking past the food bank and they'll be hungry, but it'll be 6 p.m. and it won't matter because they can just walk over to the tree, pick an apple off the branch, and have that hunger sated.
Kelly, that's a hard act to follow, isn't it?
I know, it's a beautiful image.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a number of people walk by while we're doing some of the installations and saying, well, you know, you don't want, you know, are you putting up fences? Do you want, you know, you got to keep people out or they're going to steal your food. And we said, well, this is your food. This is our food. I mean, this is really here for whoever is hungry and needs it. And that, you can just see it warming people's hearts. Like, what? You're actually putting in all this labor and effort and thought into something that I can just come and grab while I'm waiting for the bus, or and it's kind of, it seems revolutionary that we're so open to sharing. But that's really at the heart of it. We're taking care of each other at a time where we've all had, you know, the most challenging couple of years than we've ever lived through. And so this is a safety net. You know, this is saying, you know what, we're all in this together. There's strength in diversity, and let's all come together at a time where we're feeling very disconnected and create some positive change.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you, Kelly. You've laid out a project that I think is going to have a big impact on our community, and I'm really glad that people have had a chance to hear. Thank you.
Thank you.